I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
But it doesn't matter, you're immediately cutting out a huge and, let's be honest, fairly affluent part of your audience. If you're not advertising on the iPhone, then what the hell are you doing? That's stupid.
More from the tech battlefields later as we discuss the continuing war on Adobe Flash. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And we are going to start... Actually, we're going to do a pre-start this week to talk about a couple of things coming up over the next pair of weeks, which includes on the week after the one you're listening to this, we have Apple's event. It's iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, iOS, goodness knows what else event coming up. I'm going to be flying out to San Francisco for that, so you can expect a big dollop of Nate and Ian pinion. That's due. So that's coming up in week after this. but also, in the coming weeks, and I say this in 12 hours, I'll be on a plane. IFA in Berlin. I will be heading out. We're going to have a little bit of a discussion later on in the show today about what we expect to come out of IFA. But in particular, we're going to be looking at smartwatches, I think, home automation, maybe a little bit of VR. And wearables in general, I think, are still going to be quite good. I'm also kind of keen to look at some of this, what do they call it now? Not UHD. It's the HDR television.
Good old HDR. Exciting tech, that.
Yeah, expecting to see some new ones, maybe some new curved OLED panels from the likes of LG using HDR TV. So that's going to be coming up. So basically, over the next couple of weeks, you are going to have a smorgasbord of technology feasts to indulge upon with your mouth parts. And
our mouth parts, their ear parts.
Well, I'm going to be there in person, sampling everything. Yes. I'm going to gorge myself for the benefit of, 20,000 listeners. So, but we're going to get to a little bit of our expectations for IFA and Apple at the end of the first half of the show this week. And we're going to start the first half of the show with news about Uber. One that I took just a couple of hours ago from London's Euston Station back home. Now, the news here, this is according to Reuters, is that the European Commission will launch a study in September, that is this coming month, in fact, this month almost, of the ride-hailing app Uber in an attempt to settle legal disputes. It's trying, the study is, that is, to determine the legal instruments that Brussels might want to use to decide whether Uber is a transport service or just a digital service that transports people as a service. This, according to an EUA official. Now, Uber has responded by submitting complaints to the European Commission because they're a bit annoyed about German and Spanish court bans, and there's a bunch of French laws on taxis that affect Uber as well, because largely Uber still argues that it is connecting willing drivers with needy customers, and being considered a transport service makes it harder for the company to operate. That obviously would be great news for the stuck-in-the-past taxi services who are still operating on outdated thinking, let's say. Anyway, yeah. That's not to get into the debate about whether Uber is or is not a good service. We have covered that base a few times in the past. But the study does, to me at least, and this is what I present to you, Ian, it does seem to be the sign that the European Commission has to step in and do something, because there are too many European countries basically really pissed off at Uber. And yeah. Apparently, if something is to be done, that something begins with a study. What are your thoughts there?
I mean, that's very European, isn't it? A quick study of everything. I get it. The thing is about Europe is that it's supposed to be, for things like this, it is sort of supposed to be the fact that Europe will legislate. So if it decides that ride sharing, as Uber calls itself, should be legal, then it will be legal across the union. And it already is here. So, in fact, we don't have a horse in this race particularly.
We don't even have the euro, though, Chief, let's be honest.
No, but we do tend to abide by the rules, don't we? I mean, we have the European Court of Human Rights until... Well, I mean, I know that the Conservatives have said they would like to get rid of that, but, you know, I think actually it has served our purposes extremely well for a number of examples. So it would be nice if there was a unilateral sort of decision on it, and I'm sure Uber would quite like it as long as it came in their favour. But I don't know, it was such a complicated thing in terms of being called a ride-sharing service and, you know, all of the baloney that comes along with it. Like, you know, really, Uber is a taxi service. I don't think... You can't really claim it's a ride-sharing service if that's what they do.
It's innovation anymore. Being beaten up by semantics, right?
It is a bit, yes. And yeah, I suppose that's true. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to always give way to innovation just because we kind of think, oh, well, we're being innovated at. And I can see the taxi driver's point, and I can see that Uber have had a few incidents, haven't they, that have led to people being attacked as a result of getting in their cars. And that just comes down to background checking and, you know, not being particularly fastidious about the people you employ. And I'm sure that they could up their game on that and make it a bit more safe. But at the same time, I don't think it would be... Well, I like what they've done to the market. They've made it very cheap to get a cab at certain times.
Yeah. Well, the study is due to start this coming September 2015. We'll keep our eyes on that and see how that study into the usage of Uber pans out. The tablet market in the UK is doing rather well. Apparently, this is according to an Ofcom study discussed in The Guardian, the proportion of UK households that have a tablet has risen from just 2%, that was in 2011, so that was the year after the iPad was announced, to 54%, according to this Ofcom report. That is that one in every two households has a tablet computer. Now, these are most popular, the report continues, amongst people aged 34 to 54. In fact, two-thirds of this age group own those tablets. And again, that was up from just 2% in 2011, as we noted earlier. 60% of 16 to 34-year-olds have access to a tablet. And here's the interesting thing that I find. One in three children aged between 5 and 15 years also have their own device. Now, that's pretty interesting to me. One in three children aged 5 to 15 have their own tablet. But the other thing, the final figure I wanted to pull out of here, is that by 2016, by the end of 2016, Ofcom anticipates that 63% of UK homes will have a tablet, 74% of 16 to 34-year-olds will have a tablet, and 44%, so nearly half of all tablet ownership will be in the hands of somebody aged 55 or older. I think that is pretty compelling because that shows decent penetration right now of tablets. And at least according to Ofcom, it's still in demand and there are more homes that do not have one tablet who'll be getting one over the next 12 to 15 months. Now, that'd be good news for Apple, which has seen iPad sales decline. At least it's seen demand decline, largely, I think, as we've discussed in the past, Ian, because older iPads and indeed older tablets are generally very good and work perfectly well for most people. So the upgrade cycle is not as compelling to be a part of as it is with phones. But we also have a lot of other tablets coming out from the likes of Amazon, let's say, the Kindle Fire, and even things like Tesco's... what's Tesco's tablet called now?
Huddle.
The Huddle, yes. So the Huddle 2 was...
That's very, very good, actually. Yeah. Both those tablets have been surprisingly good.
The Huddle 2, in particular, was great for the price. So this is good. I would say good for tablets in the UK, Ian, but do any of these numbers surprise you?
No, because my parents are both over 60 and both of them have an iPad. And, you know, with phones, they were never very adventurous. You know, my mum now has an Android, but that she had a Nokia before that ran... I can't even remember what it ran. I suppose it must have been Series 60, but it wasn't very advanced. And Yeah, so for them to go from that, and that's completely wiped out their computer use. So now they just, they do email on their tablets, they browse, you know, there's the computer's basically gathering dust, really. And that's a shame in some ways, because I feel sad about the computer. I mean, not that I think the desktop PC is going anywhere, but it's certainly dying in that particular market. And kids, you know, my kids... Well, my Izzy's old enough to play on a tablet. We have a Kindle Fire that isn't hers, but it's a big one, so it's nice for her to play on, and she uses it all the time, and she absolutely adores it.
And what does she mostly use that for?
There's loads of really good kids' games.
Games,
in particular. Oh, yeah, almost exclusively games. We don't really go in for letting them watch TV on them or anything like that, but... the CBeebies app, I mean, God bless the BBC, that, you know, that the CBeebies app is phenomenal. And there are a couple of them. One is Stories and one is Games. And they're both such beautifully made apps that it's really nice to use them. And you know, they're safe with that kind of stuff. So none of it surprises me, really. And I was sort of aware that tablet use was sort of dropping off a bit. I don't know. I guess everyone sort of rushed out to buy a tablet, didn't they? It was one of those very surprising things. That I remember how much I laughed at the original iPad, but you know, they've totally gone and proved me wrong, haven't they?
Yeah, they have, and I agree with
brilliantly
with CBBC. That's a great one. I mean, the deaf thing is that some of the stuff that CBBC comes out with, I've downloaded at least one in the last couple of weeks, because they've got this fantastic thing that's kind of like, imagine Sonic the Hedgehog was actually a snail. Chasing a French chef with a saucepan, trying to cook said snail, and it's an addictive little fun game that came out of CBBC. And I was doing a podcast yesterday, and my girlfriend was playing that for a good 45 minutes.
That's
amazing. Playing this snail game, which was great. And so I'm assuming that's different though on the other side of your family spectrum, your parents, both of whom you said have iPads, and that the same is true for me. They, I imagine, are not playing as many games. Probably using it more for catch up TV, internet, and email.
Casual games, I think. I don't think they watch any TV on them. I think it's mostly email, casual games. I mean, you know, things like Sudoku and Candy Crush and that kind of thing. I don't know. I don't actually know what my dad uses his for. They've both been kind of resistant to reading books on them. My mum didn't even really want a Kindle, and then she got one. And I think she kind of sort of admitted that it was probably the greatest thing ever.
My mum did nothing of the sort. She didn't really want one, didn't like the idea. I gave her one. She didn't use it. Even when I bought her a book for it that I knew that she'd like, that she knew she'd like, she didn't want to read that either.
Really?
So I've pretty much conceded that there is no love to be had in her house for the Kindle.
That's fascinating,
she
isn't
loves,
it?
She's one of these classics that's like that classic people who likes books and paper. And I get that.
But doesn't everyone like books? I mean, yeah. I don't know. I read The Martian on Kindle, and I just thought I could have this book now. I could start reading The Martian now. I don't want to wait for a book to turn up.
And it's the now. We're the now generation, though, mate.
I could probably say that I suspect there are other books where I'm glad. I mean, we've got loads of books in this house, but. Honestly, how many books do I go back and reread? I mean, they look nice. I get that. But isn't it just a waste of paper?
Perhaps. But let's get back to some of these figures. So we're seeing a dramatic rise. And, you know, those figures, that looking back to some of the other figures in here, just broken out a little bit more specifically, 37% in 2015 of UK tablet owners are aged 55 or over. 55... Of people aged 55 or over, 37% of them have a tablet. Now, that would account for your parents and my parents. And in fact, my gran has an iPad, and she's actually pretty comfortable using that for gaming, for YouTube. She FaceTimes. But anyway, I don't think she's going to be using Twitter anytime soon. But it is interesting that she, you know, she features in this study and is not alone in having an iPad. So there we go. There is room in the UK hand for an additional tablet, it seems. So, tablet developers, keep going. Okay, Ian, you wanted to talk a little bit about something that pretty much broke before we started recording the show today, which is that Android Wear is going to be compatible with iOS.
Yeah, you need to have a set of very specific watches for it to work. The only one on the market right now that works is the LG Watch Urbane, which I have in front of me right now.
That's their stylish one that was unveiled at Mobile World Congress, I think.
Yes, that's correct. I've got the silver one. It's very pleasant. It goes along with the G Watch R, same screen, but a slightly more classic watchy style bezel. So that watch, and then the new ASUS, the Zen Watch 2, the new Huawei watch, and or however that word is pronounced,
Huawei,
and then another one which I forget.
Well, that's okay, because what I really want to ask is, when we say Android Wear is now compatible with iOS, what is it that's compatible? How does that work?
Google's released an app for Apple, you know, which I was actually quite surprised about, because I thought they'd managed to find a way to just do it over Bluetooth or something. But I guess you are always going to need an app. But I just sort of assumed that either Google wouldn't want to or Apple wouldn't let them put an app in the market. But they have done it, and it's I've downloaded it for my iPhone. I think there must be a watch update coming, because I can't actually get them to pair and talk to each other at the moment. So I'm just waiting to see if there's an update comes through for the watch. The Google, I don't know what is wrong with Google, but their blog entries for this stuff are absolutely appalling. The amount of information in them is just ridiculous. It says essentially these watches are supported, and that's it. You basically go for it.
So they're supported in that the app is released and allows you to sync data between.
They didn't even mention the app. I thought, do I need an app? None of it was in there. I had to go to The Verge to watch a video to discover whether there was any, whether you need an app or not. Why can't you put out some good information? I don't know. Maybe because I guess I'm not on Google's press list. Somehow I've managed to not get on it because they haven't said anything directly to me. But, you know, it's exciting news. And I've known for a while that this was potentially possible. I have a chap I speak to, a big company, and he told me a while ago that the support was coming in this version of Android for iOS. But of course, he obviously isn't privy to the machinery that goes on behind the scenes with Google and Apple.
I think we can speculate here and move this into the second bit that we wanted to discuss here, which is that this has been released now because there are going to be a metric crap ton of new Android Wear smartwatches descending on the halls of IFA in just a couple of days. And it makes sense for
Samsung. There's bound to be a Samsung one, isn't there? They've already started teasing that.
Well, they have. I mean, we know that this is... Well, there are a couple of names that I've heard this to be called. One of them is the Galaxy Gear S2.
Yes.
And that one was previously called the Gear A. I think it's called the Gear S2 because they did sort of kind of trail that at their Unpacked event, their event the other week. So that is one that is coming. We also are expecting to see another smartwatch, possibly from TomTom, certainly a wearable from TomTom is being rumored. We've got the ASUS ZenWatch 2. Actually was announced at Computex, but they are going to be giving prices and release dates out for this. Then there's also possibly another one or two from... Oh, we mentioned Huawei. That one might be compatible with Jawbone Up. Got Motorola, Samsung, as we mentioned.
Oh, yeah, Motorola. That was it. That
Was
the
and then
one.
There's the LG Nemo smartwatch, which may have a sort of... It's a square resolution, we think.
Oh, no.
But it might have a circular screen, so I don't know. But
interesting. I'm having a look now on Google to see if there's anything interesting.
It seems to me that the rumor is that that's going to continue the design trajectory that the Urbane sets out. So this all seems to me that we're going to see a lot of these watches dropping at IFA, and Android wants to make sure that for all those iOS users that are there, they're going to be writing positive things into their copy and into their reports for news outlets such as myself and yourself, that indeed Android Wear works now with iOS. So
the
a timely release
about it, which is pretty much unusual for them. So
yeah, All right. Well, IFA, I'm going to be at, and Ian will be covering as well here. So next weekend, you can expect to have some on the floor reporting from myself and what I tend to do, which is, since about 90% of my friends tend to be technology journalists in some form or another, just grab people as I see them around the show floor and demand they talk to me on the program. So that will be coming up. And then Ian and I will no doubt have a more roundup-y type section of the show for next week as well.
Oh. One thing, by the way, as well, that just occurred to me, the Samsung, there's no guarantee that will run Android Wear.
No.
I think it could run their own operating
Tizen.
System. Yeah.
Tizen.
So that's an interesting thing, because that could make it quite an interesting sell.
Well, it could, but it would also mean exclude it from the compatibility with other Android phones, couldn't it?
Well, yes, because they've never included it. But there's no reason they couldn't allow
iPhones.
That.
No. Well, we'll come back to that. We'll see what we get from there. Do check back with the show next week, and we will answer all these questions and put everything that you've heard into context. But it goes without saying that if you have opinions on the EU launching a study into Uber, or if you have use case scenarios for your children or from your parents or grandparents about usages for tech, for tablets, that is, that we haven't discussed today. Maybe you have a grandparent that uses a tablet for something particularly obscure or obscene. Who knows? But we would love to know, particularly if it's obscure, a little less so, to be honest, if obscene. Although, not that much difference, if we're perfectly honest, because both make for fantastic podcasting. Podcast at natelangson.com is where you can send obscurities and obscenities.
Honestly, I sometimes wonder if I just left you alone, if I just disconnected, what would happen? What you would just come out with?
It's time to move into a bit of feedback. We have one in particular that I wanted to read out this week. This gets to take up most of the feedback time for this week's show. Because we have a listener called Andrew, who wrote in about girls and IT GCSEs. And specifically, this is because last week we talked about how there's been a huge rise in students opting for computing as a GCSE, which includes coding and how apps work, and includes a massive rise in girls taking the course. And this is in addition to the IT classes that have existed for a very long time, which is more focused on things like spreadsheets, word processing, and what have you. Anyway, Andrew says that my eldest daughter has just finished her GCSEs. She did the computer science one rather than the standard IT. When she did it, IT was compulsory nationally, he believes. And his other daughter, who's 2 years younger, IT is no longer compulsory, and so she isn't doing it. She had to choose between IT and, for example, history or French. Now, it's Andrew says that the computer science, the computing side of things, was actually very badly taught, even though the school is apparently a specialist school in computing. He says that he ended up teaching her more the day before her exam than she'd learned through the course. The teachers were pretty clueless for many aspects, he says. But even with that, she managed a B, which he parenthetically suggests maybe that something to do with the exams being a little bit too easy might have been conducive there. And of course, his daughter's amazing abilities, he adds. But along with a great intro to programming concepts, they did have to learn weird stuff like conversions between hexadecimal and binary, which seems perfectly fair in computer science. They do come across that in computer science degrees. But he questions why that would be necessary in GCSE level studies. And he says the course certainly needs a massive refresh. For some aspects, it seems it's about 10 years out of date. So it seems that there are girls taking this course, but maybe the course actually isn't that satisfactory. And with some of these classes now not being compulsory, even though we've seen a rise over the last few years of students taking these as GCSEs, the fact that they now don't have to may mean that we see a decline. At least that's what Andrew is hypothesizing here. And he reckons in his own experience, his daughter didn't necessarily get the kind of tuition from the school that she would need to actually remain engaged in computer science. So maybe the summary here is the rise in these numbers might be a flash in a pan, and other factors may not help that trend continue in future.
Yeah, well, one problem definitely with IT that it doesn't exist, or, you know, computing, it doesn't exist in other languages and things like that so much, is that you have to keep updating it. You know, you can't, it has to be someone with a really good background in computers has to be writing the syllabus every year, because it changes so quickly. And you don't have that problem with English. Like, you know, the rules of English do not change very quickly.
Have you seen the new quarterly update to the Oxford English?
Don't call it the Oxford English OED. Dictionary, please. Yeah, the Oxford Dictionary of English, please, because I shan't have this good name of the OED sullied with this nonsense.
No, I'm a fan of the OED, but, you know, bitch face is now in there.
And isn't retweet as well made it in?
That is at least, I think, fair. I mean, if all of these are documenting the development of the English language, then I suppose all are equal. These are terms that get used.
Well, actually, one thing that's interesting, because I looked into it, because I thought, oh, it's not the OED, is it? It's the ODE. And one thing that came out of that is the OED is a history of language. So it has stuff added to it, and nothing can never be taken out of that. Whereas the ODE is updated constantly, so it's supposed to reflect the language as it is now. But they never really press announce the things they've taken out, do they? They always go big on, we've added hashtag to the English language. And I'm like, oh, for God's sakes, this wearying display again to get publicity. But they never tell us what they take out. So it'd be interesting to know, wouldn't it, what comes out of that dictionary each year.
One is Gutling, which is a great eater, from which was used in the 1600s. That's apparently been removed.
Well, that seems like a terrible shame. We should bring that back straight away.
Yeah. There's also the Anythingarian, which is one who professes no creed in particular, an indifferentist. This was used in the context in the 1700s as such bifarious Anythingarians that always make their interest the standard of their religion.
That's actually quite an interesting word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like that could be quite applicable to a certain section of society even today.
Yes.
We're letting good words die, people.
Yeah, I know. It's crazy, isn't it? Okay, well, I think that is enough of a tangent for this week. Thank you very much, Andrew, for writing in with that very interesting feedback. You too can write in with your interesting feedback, or just feedback. It doesn't have to be interesting, but of course it is preferential if it does conform to the standards of interestingness. podcast@natelangson.com. We want to move on to one final story for this week's podcast, which is that half, that's 50%, of UK web browsers are to have flash ads and autoplay video blocked by default. Half. If you look around you, people listening, see the people around you, imagine half of them don't exist. That's the extent that we're talking here. So why are flash ads and autoplay videos going to be blocked by default on UK browsers? Well, it's not just UK. I did just emphasize that for the purposes of this show being a UK-focused podcast. But it's because half of UK browsers, web browsers in the UK, are Google Chrome. And Google has set a date of September the 1st for when its Chrome browser will block all flash content that isn't, quote, central to the web page. Now, this is things like ads, auto-playing videos, or even non-video websites that have flash stuff baked into them. They'll automatically be paused by default. So if you want them to play, you have to click on them and play them. Whereas there are embeddable players, which would be considered the focus of the website. That's things like YouTube, of course, where these will play by default as they normally would. These have been teased out in earlier versions of Chrome this year, and there are additional benefits other than just the removal of annoying web page components, things like battery life, which, you know, auto-playing flash ads and looping videos running in the background. These all suck up CPU time, and that all sucks up battery power. Referring to a story here posted on Ars Technica, which has got some more detail about this, if you want to go into the detail. But Ian, I'm curious about your thoughts. Google, which has in the country, and I think globally now, the most popular web browser, saying we're not letting your flash ads and your flash videos play by default. That's a hell of a move. That's opt out. That's not opt in. Yeah. And because Chrome is very good at auto-updating and auto-updating in the background, so people don't tend to know that their browser's been updated, people are just going to suddenly stop seeing these. Now, that has a bunch of implications commercially for websites that rely on ads that for paying their staff salaries, but also for autoplay videos, which we saw in a very negative way earlier this month with the US journalist being shot on live TV, and the guy who did the shooting then immediately posted the video to Twitter, which auto-played in people's browsers in some instances, which showed a very, very bad and shocking use of what is effectively very simple technology. So a number of ways that this can, you know, this could benefit or harm people, depending on your side of the fence you sit on here. But either way, pretty big news.
Yeah, it's huge. To be honest with you, I don't know how many big ad agencies and reputable companies are still using Flash to deliver ads. The whole thing's a nightmare. We've had two instances, I think this year, of serious malware being distributed by ads that run Flash. Adobe has essentially given up on that product, hasn't it? And it isn't getting updated at the frequency. I mean, they're quite good with patches when there's a security problem, but there's no interest in Flash anymore. It is a dead technology. We've moved over to HTML5. That's great. It's a far more suitable product for delivering video online.
Yeah, and let's not forget, of course, that if it wasn't for ads, Flash probably would have died quite some time ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think some people still deliver Flash video, don't they? I mean, occasionally you get a very old video on YouTube that has that is still Flash. I think Google only transcodes videos if there's some demand for them. I mean, that would make sense, wouldn't it? It can't possibly transcode every video to HTML5. I don't quite know how the whole system works, to be honest.
But you know, there are still studies that suggest that more ads now are still Flash than HTML5. It's about, I'm looking at some numbers from a advertising company called Sysmec, which says that 55% of multimedia ad impressions, and this is actually on mobile, were still Flash.
Really?
And HTML5 with the remaining 45%.
That's so stupid, because the iPhones never supported Flash. So
no, but there are more Android phones out there. And
yeah, but it doesn't matter. You're immediately cutting out a huge and, let's be honest, fairly affluent part of your audience. If you're not advertising on the iPhone, then what the hell are you doing? That's stupid. So these ad agencies need to get their act together. If they want their ads to be seen, they've got sort of, obviously, it's in everyone's interest for ads to be displayed, right? So they can't rely on an old technology. I guess Flash has been popular with ad agencies because
it's easy.
It is easy, but it also plays. And, you know, it's one of those things. It's fairly ubiquitous. It's supported in every browser. It's an easy win, isn't it? But now that's not true. Then their ads are no longer going to autoplay, which means that most of them are going to break because they won't be showing. I mean, I don't. Chrome, for me, I disabled Flash a long time ago. In fact, I've disabled all plugins in Chrome.
I will be honest, when I bought the new MacBook, the gold 12-inch thing they released a few months back, model they released a few months ago, I've still to this day not installed Flash on it. And I haven't really noticed my experience using the web to have been hindered by that.
Well, me neither. You just don't need it.
No.
I mean, okay, some ads may not play. I still have the plugin, but it's disabled, and I have to manually click up. There's a big grey box pops up for any plugin now, and I have to manually. And you'd be surprised, you don't see it a lot. So, brilliant.
Well, we are going to move into a future where Flash is increasingly dead. I mean, this is sort of, it's beginning to feel now like we're on the final stretch in terms of beating the crap out of Flash. This is the last set of hammers being given out to beat it to death, isn't it? Because if ads are the last thing keeping Flash alive, and you've now got the world's biggest browser blocking those by default, you're pretty much going to see a stark decline in Flash usage.
And am I right in
it will raise some interesting questions for ad agencies, because they will have to immediately go back to their clients. I know this might be a little bit boring for some listeners, so I'll be very brief, but if they have to start going back and explaining why it is they're getting much lower engagement overnight for their clients, and they're going to have to start explaining, well, it's because we use technology called Flash and Flash is now blocked XYZ. Clients don't care about that. They just want results. They're going to say, well, make it work. So we could hopefully start seeing this be a real overnight driver of higher quality ads on the web. Whether that's happening soon enough, because obviously ad block is so incredibly prevalent in web browsers, I don't know, but it's going to be interesting to see. That's from the 1st of September. So let us know what you think. Are you plugged into this idea and smiling, or are you blocking it out because you hate it so much? Let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. Your view on the death of Flash, or indeed anything else we've talked about earlier in the show. We're going to wrap this up like a beautiful Christmas present. Ian, it is to you I look for to be the bow on this gift. I will be the sellotape.
Magnificent.
And you can look forward to unwrapping an EFA-tastic present next week as we talk about the EFA Tech Trade Show. I'll be Santa Claus, and I look forward to eating mince pies with you then.
That's been the most, from the very minute you started that podcast, it's been the most Partridge. When you mentioned Uber, you said that I got this very evening over from Houston, and I just thought, and I immediately thought Partridge. That's brilliant. See if anyone else notices that.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.